So we're here in Silicon Valley visiting with Omar Shaheen. We're about 1,000 miles from Redmond. You can not quite see Redmond from your window, but it's aimed the right way at least. Nice sunset too. Hey, you guys have sun down here in Silicon Valley. That's unfair.
Most days.
Yeah, so up in Seattle, we're entering the rainy season. Yeah, the next 5 months of rain.
Yeah.
What do you do here?
So I am a lead program manager on the Hotmail front door team, and
What does that mean?
so what is lead program manager or front
Oh,
door
front
team?
door to you.
So front door team is the group within Hotmail that owns all of the technology that's internet facing except for mail delivery. So all the servers that when users type in hotmail.com and they get redirected to a web server, all the servers involved in connecting to your data are front door servers.
Right.
When you use Outlook or Outlook Express to get your mail through Hotmail, it uses DAV interfaces. All the DAV servers are Hotmail front door servers. Some customers can still use POP servers, like the MSN customers.
Right.
Those are all front door servers. So there's a number of servers that my team owns the technology, so owns the software running on those servers. That's the front door team. And the back end team owns mail delivery and spam filtering, inbound spam filtering, as well as all the servers that store data for users. So all of our servers don't store anything at all.
Now we just got a tour of the SQL Server team, and you're using SQL Server. Can you talk a little bit about how much transactions go through that SQL Server or through your server file?
I'm not the best person to answer that question. The way our backend works is all the headers for your mail are stored in SQL databases, and all of the individual messages in your mail account are stored as files on disk, and the SQL Server just points to those files. So I'm not exactly sure how many transactions a second they handle, but it's pretty significant. We handle about 2 billion pieces of inbound mail that is made it through the spam filter. So we handle much more mail than that doesn't even get to the back end. So they're able to handle that much mail delivery
That's per day or
per
per
day.
Wow. 2 billion pieces per day.
And that's mail that we believe is not spam. So on top of that, we probably handle twice or more of that just hitting our servers. And there's a lot of servers to handle that, a lot of queuing, a lot of technology involved in identifying those messages as spam. And that's, I think, where Hotmail is offered to innovate, is able to innovate a lot faster than some of the competition because we can leverage technology from Microsoft Research, the Smart Screen filter. But then we have about 200 million active users. So we handle about 50 million logins a day. So for every login, there's quite a significant number of transactions that occur from the front door to the back end. As soon as you hit your inbox, you have to go get all your headers. So the scale of the system is there's probably nothing else like it, at least in the mail space.
I wish you could get me into the data center. I hear it's quite impressive.
It is. The data center is probably one of the most impressive places I've ever visited. It's kind of hard to explain, but I
It
was.
straight out of a science fiction movie or something?
It's very noisy, for one thing. It's very cold, it requires an incredible amount of power, and has a big, pretty large staff to maintain it. But it's hard to explain exactly what it's like to look at thousands and thousands of servers.
Yeah. We were in the SQL Server. The SQL Server team gave us a tour through their four labs, which have thousands of machines, I guess, among the four labs. We got to crawl around an HP Superdome, which had 2,500 hard drives attached to it. So I can just, people on Channel 9 are going to have a chance to see that. I can just imagine that scale, on a whole nother level.
Yeah, and it's
Because
interesting.
that's just a test machine for SQL Server, so I can just imagine Hotmail having a lot bigger.
Yeah, and there's some really funny looking machines in there too. Like some of the machines that back up, the tape backup machines, are really large, complicated looking devices that I've never even seen anything like it before. It's not like something you go into Fry's and you can just see. They're very specialized hardware that, you know, very few companies actually invest in purchasing.
I think we talked about this with Stephen Toulouse, who's the head of the Security Response Center here, but explain to me what phishing is.
Phishing is a really bad problem right now.
It's spelled P-H.
P-H-I, yeah.
It's not like phishing for fish. It's P-H.
It's a bad kind of phishing.
It's a bad kind of phishing.
Phishing is basically people will craft emails that look just like an email you might get from PayPal or Citibank, typically financial institutions that you have relationships with. So say you have an eBay PayPal account and you use that to pay people when you buy options. Well, the phishers, what they'll do is they'll send an email to you and using technology that's actually just off the shelf, they can craft the message such that all the links appear to point to eBay, all the images, that everything looks identical. All the headers are forged, though, so that when you click a link, it's actually taking you to their website, and they ask you to enter your username and password. Well, you don't know that you're going to someone else's website, and users don't necessarily know to look for the little lock icon in the browser to know that it's a secure connection or not, but they basically fake the address in the address bar so you don't notice it. And so you enter your username and password, and once you do that, you're finished because the company that's sent you this email basically has your username and password now. They can go log into your eBay account for you and, you know, withdraw all your funds or pay themselves or pay people money. It's a really bad problem in countries like Australia where so many people do online banking. There's such a high predominance of that those banks really are suffering because they're having to deal with the fact that their customers are very used to getting communications from their bank and doing things online. So we're spending a lot of time trying to help users learn to identify messages that are forged, but also just build technology so that we can, you know, put those messages in the junk mail folder or delete those messages if we can determine with 100% certainty that they're phishing mails.
Now, I've been on Hotmail for 5 years. And it certainly has gotten a lot better in terms of spam. I don't get my email address is in the public, right? So that's up on the web blog.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to get a lot more than I do today. So thank you for cleaning up my inbox for a while. But I'm still getting a little bit, and I'm now getting false positives. Or in other words, some of my real email is getting thrown into my junk mail. How can I keep that from happening?
So we did two things recently that have caused a lot of sort of problems around that area. One is we actually had a bunch of rules that we weren't able to use because of performance reasons, and we recently enabled those. And that's actually resulted in increasingly more false positives for users. The other problem is a lot of users weren't using our junk mail filter, so when a lot of people complained about Hotmail not, you know, being the spam target and all this stuff. They need to realize that Hotmail has 200 million users, so it's the biggest target in the world for these spammers. And these spammers are incredibly sophisticated. They will spend a lot of money and time and resources trying to get spam into our system. So a very small percentage of our customers actually had the junk mail filter, the smart screen filter enabled, which meant that they were, you know, not benefiting from all the technology we had. So we actually went and turned on the junk mail filter for all of our customers a few months ago. This is something that Yahoo actually does for, you know, all their new accounts. So, you know, we figured it was definitely the right time to do it, given the amount of spam out there. And the end result was a lot of people all of a sudden realized that, you know, they're getting a lot less junk mail, but now a couple of things here or there are going into their junk mail folder. The best thing you can do to make sure that things that are important to you are not getting into your junk mail folder are to make sure that people that you exchange mail with are in your address book, or you add certain domains that you frequently exchange mail with to your whitelist. But that's obviously not going to solve the problem, because all these spam filters are using are heuristics. You know, they can't make 100% certain decisions about every piece of mail.
Right.
So there's a lot of work going into technology to allow companies that are legitimate bulk mailers, you know, my banks are legitimate bulk mailers. They send mail to all their customers. They don't have any way necessarily guaranteeing that that's not going to be filtered by every ISP out there in the world. So there's a lot of effort going into defining programs that these banks can get into so that they can guarantee their mail is delivered. So I think over time what you'll see is a lot of companies that are in the business of sending broad communications that you've opted into will better be able to deal with, you know, the uncertainty of the delivery of that mail. It's actually a big problem now that a user, if I send you a piece of mail, there's no guarantee that that mail is going to get to you. Sure, within Microsoft, you know, I can be pretty sure that it's going to show up in your inbox. You may not read it because you get hundreds of pieces of mail, but if I send my parents a piece of mail, I have no guarantee that they're going to get that. And that's, you know, a pretty unsettling problem right now. So I think it's a hugely important thing for the industry to work on, and definitely something we're spending a lot of time on.
One of my interview questions was explain the architecture of something. So could you go on the whiteboard and explain the architecture of Hotmail and tell me what happens when I send an email? Or?
Sure. So this will be a simplified view of the world, but we'll call this is a Hotmail front door server. Mm-hmm. And we'll make this cloud the internet. Actually, let me just make this easier. I'll draw an end user on their computer. Yeah, the internet. So user goes and connects to the Hotmail front door. Now what happens is the user actually gets redirected. Hotmail doesn't know anything about passwords.
Right.
So we don't know what your password is. All we want to know is that you're authorized to get at the mail for the account that you say you own the password to. So what happens is we redirect you to Passport, and then you get a cookie, and then you come back to us. And if the cookie's valid, the front door says, okay, you're a valid user, and now we're going to log you in. So there's a back-end server, big database, and there's a bunch of code in the middle. Front door server basically says, hey, so-and-so wants to get their mail. Well, you can imagine we have thousands upon thousands of these databases.
Right.
So the system we have in the middle here is kind of like DNS. So you come to the front door and it says, hey, I want to get my mail. And then this server, we don't know who to go talk to. So this server says, hey, this user Joe is located on, you know, this store over here. So now we go and we talk to this server. And we get your headers, and we go back, and we render them. And so we have a bunch of servers and code and content that goes and pulls out strings depending on your language, that pulls out graphics, that pulls out the HTML, and essentially builds a web UI and then presents it to the user. And, you know, this is a very simplified view of how things work, but it's actually kind of, you know, it's pretty similar to that. Now, if you send a message, it actually doesn't involve the backend at all, but when I go to a compose view and I, you know, type someone's name and I write something and hit send, the front door actually has an SMTP server. And what we will do is then we will go and we'll deliver these messages. So every front door server, there are thousands and thousands of these servers, will go and deliver these messages, you know, back out into the internet. And that's how send works. Receive works entirely differently. So on receive, you know, we have all these other servers. So a piece of mail comes in, and there's quite a bit of software that actually takes this piece of mail, checks to see if you're a spammer, checks to see if your IP address is blocked, checks the contents of the messages, it does a whole bunch of things to figure out if a message is good or bad. If a message is good, in a very similar manner than the front door, these servers go and find out, hey, where is this user located? They figure out where the user is located, and then these servers go and deliver the mail directly to the back end. So there's actually no front door servers involved whatsoever in mail delivery, and it's all handled by the inbound SMTP servers.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so it's actually if you think about it, mail systems shouldn't be that complicated. They basically handle inbound mail. They store mail, and they let the user see their mail.
Right.
But we have, you know, dozens of different types of users. We have MSN users. We have partnerships with companies. You know, we recently did a partnership with Bell Canada. So we have a very complicated system for being able to handle lots of different types of users, lots of different types of accounts, different size storage. users have, you know, number of days they have to log in or they lose their account. Messages are deleted from the trash every X number of days. So there's a lot of business logic involved in actually managing the system.
Now, some messages have advertising on them, right?
You mean they come from Hotmail?
Yeah.
Yeah, so Hotmail will send messages to their user base. Things like, you know,
When I'm reading an email from somebody. In the UI, uh-huh. It has that. So that comes from MSN somewhere else?
MSN is a centralized advertising system that Hotmail leverages.
Okay.
We don't do any content. You know, our advertising system is purely based on what's in your profile, what's in your passport profile, what's in your MSN profile, which is, you know, it works for us, but it's not as flexible as Google, who say can figure out, hey, I'm reading an email about blogging, so I'm going to pull some ads about blogging and show them to this person. It's just a different model. We have more of a TV style advertising where we show ads. You know, you see ads on TV for, you know, very generic audiences based on shows. That's kind of how our advertising works.
Interesting.
Thanks. You know,
for explaining this to me, because it's interesting. Yeah, so much of our mail and so many people are on the system, and it's sort of interesting to understand how it all works. And this is literally thousands of machines. This is not, you know, this isn't two boxes sitting in the corner somewhere.
it's a very gigantic system, and there's actually quite a huge number of people that are actually involved in making sure that it stays up.
Do you get calls on the weekends when it goes down? Or?
Luckily for me, I don't have to deal with that kind of stuff. There is 24/7 monitoring of the servers in the data center. I don't know if you got to see, there's a network operations center next to the cafeteria, and there's staff in there all day, 24/7 monitoring servers. All the servers are built such that if there are any problems, they basically fire alarms, and, you know, people can then go and monitor them. But, you know, servers go down, hardware fails every day. With the number of servers we have, the statistics are such that, you know, hard drives die, machines die, so all this stuff is, we try and build it as automatic as possible, so that, you know, users aren't impacted.
Right. And this stuff is stored on multiple machines, because if one goes down, my email doesn't disappear, right?
That's right. It doesn't matter if a front door machine goes down, because front door machines are all stateless. Back-end machines, depending on the architecture on the back-end, whether it's our older or our newer one, if a server goes down, what will happen typically is users will be unable to get at their mail until the service is restored again. Like power might go out, if, you know, a fan might die or something. In that case, you know, there's really nothing you can do until you just get it back up again. There are other architectures obviously out there where, you know, you have multiple copies of the person's data on the network, so that if, you know, one part of the network goes down, you're still able to do things.
Are you guys beta testing any of the new SQL Server stuff coming out next year?
No, not right now. We're basically fully just working on SQL Server 2000. Nobody's looking at UConn stuff yet. It's not clear that the issues we're looking at now have more to do with architecting the ecosystem and the actual system itself, as opposed to working with specific technology. That's now for the front door team. It's entirely different. So we are looking at all the new goodies coming out in WebP. And this new CLR, and there's actually quite a bit of stuff. So our front door servers are all, they're running on IIS 6, but it's all ISAPI and C++ code. They're basically DLLs that these servers run. We have a POP server that I mentioned, which is actually managed code. So it's a .NET server. It was our first .NET sort of front door server. It supports SSL, so Everett, which is 1.1 in the .NET framework, doesn't allow you to do SSL. It's not natively supported for POP, for instance. We have to write our own, we have to write a whole bunch of code ourselves to do that. And something like, you know, the great thing about WIPI is a lot of that stuff is now, we don't have to worry about maintaining our code to do SSL anymore. So there are a lot of things we're looking forward to. And a lot of our code is going in a managed direction, so we're building a lot more sort of chunks and pieces of Hotmail that are built in managed code and leveraging a lot of other teams' code in the company that's all built and managed. So it's actually very exciting to be able to work on that stuff now, since, you know, Libby's bringing a lot of new stuff down to us.
Yep. It'll be interesting to see how you guys make use of that.
Yeah.
So I hear you're a toy freak, and I see your smartphone over there, and I heard you had a...
So I have an audio box just like you.
Yep.
I have my little MSN Butterfly screen on it.
All right. And you have a little Rio, too, or what was
that? Yeah, I have a Rio Carbon.
Show that.
So this is my Rio. I just got this. So I had an iPod. I had three iPods, actually.
You had three iPods. How do you get away with doing that at Microsoft?
I worked on Mac software for so long.
Oh, you're one of those rebellious Apple guys, huh?
Right. So, you know,
I'm kidding. We have a lot of fun here.
For the longest time, the iPod was the only game in town, but there are finally devices out there that I would consider, or I have considered, obviously, I replaced my iPod with this. You know, it's only 5 gigs, but it's so small, and...
it is smaller than my iPod, isn't it?
The great thing is I don't have to manage a MP3 or AAC audio library anymore. I ripped all my music from day one as Windows Media Audio lossless, since I never wanted to rip music ever again after I did it once, and I just bought big hard drives and did that. And Windows Media Player is cool in that you can plug in a portable device like this, and it will automatically convert lossless to...
Now, why would you use Windows Media instead of an MP3 format?
Well... there was no lossless version out there two years ago when Windows Media Player 9 shipped, okay. Unless you just ripped it as straight, like, WAV or whatever, but I didn't want to do that. I don't think MP3 sounds very good. 128K MP3 doesn't sound good. 128K AAC is marginally better. 128K Windows Media Audio is actually tolerable. And the nice thing about using Windows Media Audio is it's really well supported in Windows Media Player, so that when I plug in that device... I can say automatically convert all my audio to 128 or 160. You know, 2 years from now when there's a better codec out there, I can just select it and it'll just automatically work. I don't know that any other company does anything like that. Apple doesn't do it in iTunes. So if you rip everything as lossless in iTunes or, you know, create these huge MP3 files, you have to create multiple versions of them, one for your device and one for your PC at home. I have a media center, so... when I'm at home in my stereo, I want full fidelity. I don't want MP3. You know, I don't want some lossy version where, you know, bits were thrown away to make it sound, you know, to make it compressed. So, yeah, there's no other product which does that. And for me, that's a really big deal. So a lot of people don't have that requirement, but I do.
Yeah. So how does this really compare to the iPod in terms of usability and coolness and all that stuff?
Well, it's one of the few devices that's got the Plays For Sure new logo, which means that, in theory, you can just plug it into Windows Media Player 10 and automatically sync, just like the iPod. It charges from my PC using USB. The iPod that I own didn't do that. I know the new ones charge over USB. But PCs don't have FireWire. I don't care what people think. You know, my Toshiba tablet doesn't have it.
No, mine doesn't either.
So FireWire is just not an option.
Now, do you use a tablet in tablet mode? You're like me. I use a keyboard most of the time. But
I use it 10% of the time. And I don't know. Do you have this crazy dock?
No, not yet.
Have you seen it?
No.
Yeah, so you basically... can put your computer on the dock and rotate it.
Oh, that's cool.
And I have a piece of software that one of our, I don't know if it's going to work right now, one of our developers on the back-end team wrote this software called Poly. I don't have it installed. But it basically lets me use my keyboard and mouse on the tablet.
Yeah, there's a... Share KMC as well from
there. Yeah, so Poly's a million times better than that.
Oh, don't tell me.
Well, it's better because it lets you use, like, have your media keys always program on one PC. It works really well. It's really fast, and then it also draws this nice big arrow on your screen so you know where your mouse is. So it makes it really easy to find, you know, your cursor. I mean, I used Share KMC for a while, and and before I knew about Poly, it was great.
But you can't get Poly outside of Microsoft.
No.
But one of the kickbacks of working at a nice company.
You know, one of the kickbacks working here is there's hundreds of pieces of custom developed software that, you know, a lot of people spend a time to make it so their software can get out there in the wild, but it's time consuming, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't have the time to do that. I've written a bunch of software that I've put on my website, but it takes a lot of time to do that.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for showing us your toys. Mm-hmm. That's pretty neat. And thanks for spending some time with us.
No problem.